The following shiur is being recorded for TorahDownloads.com, a project of the Yehuda Mann Foundation, Le'ilui Nishmas Yehuda Aryeh ben Yoshua Yakir.
We were speaking about different things that test the veracity of Torah Shebe Ksav, and one of the things that we need to talk about is archaeology. Last time we had mentioned, we had read from a few places about how everything archaeology has found till now has basically confirmed everything in the Torah. The historical events, the places, almost everything is as was. I'd like to discuss archaeology in general because every so often they do come up with something where they will attempt to test the Torah. And it's good just to have a general sense of some points of it. I will be using, the book is called LaRousse, Encyclopedia of Archaeology. LaRousse is a very famous French publishing house. This was translated from the French. It is basically written by professors in the Sorbonne, the LaRousse, L'Archéologue, de Couverté des Civilisations de Paris. The English edition was in 72, and this is the edition I have is 87, which means it's fairly recent. And it is a very nice introduction about archaeology in general and certain things specifically. This is a very, very mainstream chashuva work, and I just wanted to reach a few to say over a few things so we have a sense of when we talk about archaeology, what's happening, and so on. Let's read a sentence. This is page 9. Although archaeology can from time to time recover precise knowledge and can thus take its place among the exact sciences, this knowledge is always severely limited. By taking into account the stratigraphy, which means the layer of soil, the fabric, and the decoration, it can be stated, for example, that a certain vase of potsherd was made in Athens between 510 and 500 BC, and in some cases it even possibly named a potter. But as soon as a shift is made from definite facts to general deductions, the possibility of inaccuracy creeps in and increases in proportion to the scope of speculation. In other words, we dig up a place. I've seen a lot of archaeological digs because I used to teach in Eshet Torah, I used to walk there every day, and they were digging all the time, there's still a lot of digging and they're still creating sites and so on and so forth. What happens is you dig, you don't find a little temple. That doesn't happen. You find rocks, bits, pieces. It's clear when you look at it with even the untrained eye that this was a structure. It's clear that there are not so many rocks that are shaped and carved just by accident in one place. You can develop a lot of parallel understandings. In other words, you say to yourself, certain types of materials were not available for such and such a year, and so on. But in a certain sense, everything rests on everything else. In other words, once you've made a determination that they didn't know how to work iron until a certain age, we can draw a line and say that iron was a certain age, and so on. But that's kind of begging the question. Maybe your first premise was wrong, and this is the first piece of evidence that iron could have been done later, and so on. You find a broken pot with some Greek symbols on it in Israel. So you say, oh, the Greeks were in Israel. But maybe it was a guy who went on a trip abroad and brought back some vases. Maybe it was a merchant who came by and forgot his vase over there, and so on. There is no clear absolute ruler with which you can start measuring things and then say, okay, now I have what to measure it by. Even the chronology was terrible. People did not keep a calendar in those days. Even halachically, we date shtaris by the rule of kings. That's the Mishnah Rosh Hashanah, that Abba Rosh Hashanah Lemlachim, and Abba Rosh Hashanah, one is Lemlachim, because you dated shtaris by king. Those were things that were kind of absolute. When such and such king ruled, it was absolute, it was great, it was fantastic, and that was that. So to establish a perfect chronology is very difficult because you have different cultures without clear, no culture, no one set up and wrote a list of who were the parallel kings in other countries at the same time. So there are parts that do, you know, when we have a war, for instance, and we say in one place we find material that says in this and this year, so and so forth against him, and the other place you find this and this year, so and so forth against him, you can sort of cross-reference stuff. But a lot of times you have to guess. You have kings that we know about and long periods that we don't know about. Like every good science, we do have to start with some sort of working hypothesis. You can't wait for every piece. It's like the police investigating a murder. People who are not bright think that Sherlock Holmes is the way it's done. The police go in completely, completely unbiased. They have no idea who the suspect is. They lay down on the floor with a big magnifying glass, find two or three threads, and they come up with the answer. The real truth is the exact opposite. Police says, well, why would somebody be killed? Either it's a family member got into a fight, somebody trying to rob him, or, you know, some other reason. Let's find those suspects, and we'll also look for clues, and we'll try to match them up. But you need a working hypothesis to work with things. So you construct a timeline that seems reasonable, and you check back and forth. But there is nothing like an absolute timeline. Those are, let's read another piece here. This is page 95, and it says chronological systems of the ancient world. This is establishing dates. It's a chapter called Establishing Dates, and it's about how objects and monuments are dated. Objects dated by inscription, chronological system of the ancient world. Unfortunately, the archaeologist is up against a serious problem already: the problem of translating ancient references into terms of current chronology. The classical world, often dated by natural events, particularly astronomical sightings. And that's very nice when you mention the eclipse. It's nice when you mention the great storm that everybody knew. It doesn't help you very much 3,000 years later when you're trying to figure out what we're talking about. Also, there's another fact. Kings and people writing monuments tended to lie. It's nothing's new. Truth wasn't the first virtue on the shopping list, and therefore, whether the king won or lost a battle, he was usually, they had spins, and they would write they won it, and they would extend their kingdom, and so on. So the establishing of the dates has not been great. Well, we all know that there is there are also objective dating, which we call radioactive magnetic material. Let's read about that, page 109. There will always be a mass of material to which typological methods cannot be applied, but which is datable by other methods. In case of carbonized organic material, those of physical science are helpful, because, I'm just paraphrasing, when everything that's alive has a certain amount of radioactive carbon, after death, it's dispersed at a certain uniform rate because the half-life of radioactive material is very fixed, and we can measure the residue of the radioactive carbon. By the way, it's only good for the last 50,000 years, not good for anything earlier. It is true that this method, disputed by some, includes a margin of error which varies according to age of the specimen. For example, for substances some 2,000 years old, the margin is in the order of 200 to 300 years. This alone makes the method unsatisfactory for classical times onwards, because documentary records usually furnish a more precise date. Moreover, the rate of disintegration can be accelerated or slowed down if the specimen has been subjected to a variety of chemical reactions. If, for instance, it has been exposed to rain. So the dating of radioactive material, which is something which can be affected by rain, by water, by other chemical activities that we have no doubt about. Theoretically, the radioactive disintegration itself is fixed. That we know. That's one of those are very fundamental laws of physics, and it doesn't change. But you have to understand something. We're not talking about the rate of disintegration of the material, but the rate that that material can leach out of the specimen. So it's really a crude. People apply the absolute standard of physical phenomena, physics phenomena, to this. But you're talking about material that has a material that's absorbed and can be affected in many ways. So there are different methods, and what you try to do is that you try to use different methods and see if they are similar. There are some other things. You have a building with a fireplace in it, and there are a lot of samples in the fireplace because people cook stuff, but it's not always the same age as the building and so on. So it is a method, and it does yield some results, but it's not fantastic. As far as biblical archaeology goes, there is a chapter about it also, 176, and page 176, and it does actually say that, let me see if I can read this exact statement, speaks about Israel and Jordan, when archaeology developed, it was in the mid-1800s. The value of the Bible as a historical document became obvious. It was confirmed by the discovery in 1868 of the stele of King Mes of Moab. Stele are big columns with carved out statements and stuff like that, bearing a long inscription in a language similar to Hebrew and a script similar to the ancient Phoenician text. It commemorates a passage of arms between Mes and Israel, which is described in the Old Testament in Malachim 2, chapter 3. And basically it goes on to say that, so this was indicated, and then it goes on to say that almost everything, the British did a lot of excavations, except for Tel Elat Gasul, the names quoted above are those of ancient cities as they appear in the Old Testament, as identified by experts. The excavations conducted since 1920 therefore confirm the historical validity of the Bible. Building objects in ancient Hebrew texts will also seem to be full of information on various periods of history, as well as the contacts between Palestine and other countries. So basically, by and large, archaeologists confirmed the vast amount of truth in the Torah. Yes, Pinchas?
It would seem to me that, I haven't read this book, but it seems as referring to the geography of Israel, that there was this city there, and there was this king at this time.
Yes,
and
correct. The places, exactly.
Right.
But at least the one thing that we do see is that there was an extraordinary sense of accuracy, like we spoke last time, when tall tales tend to be short. It's always Never Neverland and Gubu Mubu, the king of the something or others. Here, the stories take place within a very, very specific context that are accurate. Yes.
But there are many stories in Tanakh which, at least from my perspective, I would think that there would be some record in other archaeologies. For example, the defeat of Sennacherib's army in one night when they were charging in the days of Yeshayahu
Good. So
Hezekiah in Jerusalem, or Yetzias Mitzrayim, where there's destruction of Egypt, and even though Egypt might not say anything about that for their own self-interest, but other nations would say Egypt was destroyed,
right?
Or Sennacherib's army was destroyed. Sennacherib was a powerful army at that time, and he was wiped out in one night. Then I would think there'd be something somewhere else at least.
So
I'm just wondering if
yes. Okay, so now we come to the other flip side. The archaeology record as such is almost always, it's been confirming. What about the stuff that's written that's not there? So there is, for that itself, there's a very interesting, a very plausible explanation. I would like you to pick up a dozen biographies of big people, autobiographies, not biographies, sorry, autobiographies, and take a look for the chapter in each autobiography that is the terrible things I've done. You'll be very hard to find them. If you read autobiography after autobiography, everybody did only great things. Occasionally you get like a very big Baal Tshuva who write the terrible things I've done and have changed my life around. But people are not inclined to write about their failures. Certainly today, even when we're sophisticated and it's in vogue to write a little bit about your human side, there were no newspapers in those days where people sat and recorded events. Kings would establish monuments to their greatness and to their virtuosity and heroism, etc., etc. Nobody put up a monument for defeat except by the country that defeated you. The victors put up monuments, the losers slunk back with the tail between the legs and forgot about the whole thing. So it would be very hard put that Ashur or Sancheyev would write, Avoisai, I really bit the dirt when I invaded the Israelites and so forth. They were not in a mood. There is a famous Egyptian spell which describes all sorts of terrible plagues that have occurred in Egypt, that the gods were angry with them, that sort of people say coincide with Yisrael Mitzrayim. I take these things with a grain of salt. The spell does exist, that is fact, and so on and so forth. But once again, the dating is vague and so on. I also want to point, so we have generally now, I did quote the sentence about actually archaeology supports the Torah. And I want to add a point to this. When you have a picture, there's a game. One of the games you have, contests and games that you have in magazines, a lot of times they'll have a cartoon or a picture and give a caption to the picture, to the cartoon, and you'll get a wonderful, amazing riot of all sorts of cute captions and many that seem to fit the picture. The Torah is a written record which gives a caption. If the archaeology fits, then it snaps into place. Like you said before, written records are extremely helpful in identifying. It's just like in a court case. Let's use it as an analogy because it's a great analogy. When the Sherlock Holmes marches into the courtroom with two threads and a piece of glue, it's cute. When you got the best case against somebody is a confession with corroborating evidence. Confessions alone we tend a lot of mistrust. A person may have been coerced, that's one. Secondly, the person may have psychologically been coerced. You have people imagining things and so on and so forth. But when we have both, they tend to complement each other. He was in such and such a place, and his footmark is there. When his footmark is there, he protests, and he says he's never there. Somebody might have taken shoe and put a footmark there. It's unlikely, but it could be. So there is something that to be said, when you find archaeological evidence that snaps into place, like the Treaty of Tisnet and described in Nach, it's very powerful. If you find evidence that's vague, lacking, we don't know, and, I'm not saying it can't be not like that, from a secular point of view, but it's much harder, an unnamed picture, we find a pot somewhere, shards and stuff like that, doesn't seem to match the picture, there may be other explanations. That's, like he says here, the problem with an archaeological site is you're looking at things and you have to guess what are the things you're looking at. So those are elements of, so archaeology has, like we saw last time, I read the article in the Britannica, it started out with a world of skepticism. I mean, if people were to dig up and to find evidence of Zeus and Jupiter and so on in the Greek mythology, they would be highly shocked. People had that same attitude for the Bible, and they were very, very surprised that the history, by and large, is followed, and so on. The Jews did not seem to construct many steles. The type of grand monuments was alien to the Jews, and we don't have our own records that would say we did this and this happened and so on and so forth. We have it in the Torah and the Nevi'im and Ksuvim and so on and so forth. There is another thing that has crept up over the years. It's quite famous, it's matching up foreign cultures and ideas to Yiddishkeit. And there are two very famous works. There's the Epic of Gilgamesh, which quote-unquote is similar to the accounts in Bereishis, and there is the Code of Hammurabi laws, which are quote-unquote similar to the Torah, and therefore the natural science, quote-unquote scientific explanation is we took the stories from them, refined it and sharpened it. Hammurabi's the codes have been dated to to be like 300-400 years before modern Torah, kind of, maybe even more, and so on. And and that's why we have a quote unquote problem. How can you have the Chukim of Torah predating the Torah? Obviously, the Torah borrowed from it, and so on and so forth. Let's, before we even look at it, these are kind of batted around as being obvious and given and so on and so forth. There are a few issues. First of all, the Code of Hammurabi actually happens to be not the only code. There are a whole bunch of other codes from that era. These codes, the dating of the codes is imprecise. They are officially given as anywhere between 1600 to 1800 and 1900 BC, Matan Torah being 1300 BC, putting it anywhere between 200-300 years before to 500-600 years before. The later dating puts it after Avraham Avinu, just so that we have some sense of it. And that's one point. Secondly, you read them and it sounds very much like the language of the Torah. There's a problem. The language that they were written, or the alphabet, is called cuneiform, which is somewhere between hieroglyphics and slowly over the ages became more like a written language. It has something like 1,600 different characters at its large end, and I think like 400 characters at its small end. It's not language. It's pictures, pictures with some nuances of language. And the people transcribing these cuneiforms use the language of the Torah to fit it. So when you see an Eved being beaten by a master, and the Eved giving a, and the master giving some coins, the translation goes Kiyake Odonis Avodov Chomish Golem Yitzchoshim Shekel Yitzchelon, so on and so forth. Remember, that's not a translation. It's a caption given to it, and that's why it sounds, sounds like the Torah. Yes, the person writing it used, and for good reason. You know, this is classic language, and we'll translate into classic language. But that's not at all what it's like. Cuneiform is a very, it's a bridge language between representative to pictographic, and it is not as neat. And there are disagreements about different translations. But let's take a look at the flavor of it. I'm not going to go. The code starts with Hammurabi's code of laws. Starts with first of all, when Anu the Sublime, King of the Anuki, and Bel, the Lord of Heaven and Earth, which is Baal, who decreed the fate of the land, assigned to Marduk, the overruling son of E, God of righteousness, dominion of earthly man, made him great among the Gigi, and called Babylon by his illustrious name, so on and so forth. He refers to all sorts of different gods over here. If you want to get a sense of what Avodah Zarah is, Hammurabi the prince called of Bel Amai, making riches and increase, enriching Nippur and Duri Luban, compare, sublime patron of Ikur, who established Eridu and purified the worship of the Apsu, who conquered Foko's world, made great the name Babylon, rejoiced the heart of Marduk, who pays his devotions to Sagil, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's real Avodah Zarah. The brother of the gods Amama, so on. The Code of Laws translated reads, one, so there are 280 laws over here. Nothing, no klolim of Asisa Hatova Yosha, you know, Kimashing Adorish Mimchol, just laws. The first one, just like, if anyone ensnares another, putting a ban upon him, but he cannot prove it, then he that ensnared him shall be put to death. Nothing. Nothing like it. If anyone brings an accusation against a man, and the accused goes to the river and leaps in the river, if he sinks in the river, his accuser shall take possession of his house. But if the river proves that the accused is not guilty and he escapes unhurt, then he who has brought the accusation shall be put to death, while he who has leaped in the river shall take possession of the house that belongs to his accuser. Which we understand now, the halacha, why if he should get out of swim. It's very, very, very important. If anyone brings an accusation of any crime before the elders and does not prove what he has charged, he shall, if it be a capital offense charged, be put to death. If somebody steals the property of a temple or the court, he shall be put to death. If anyone buys a son of a slave of another man without witness a contract, and so on and so forth. If you steal cattle or sheep or an ass or a pig or a goat, if it belongs to a god, the thief shall pay 30-fold therefor. This is going on and on over here, and there are very few laws. For instance, if anyone steals the minor son of another, he shall be put to death. Gonev isha mecharo, not due to a minor. Now, someone say, well, it's similar. Well, kidnapping, being a capital offense, can be similar. I mean, yes, kidnapping is a common offense. People did it for all sorts of reasons, and it is a terrible offense. But to say that it had to be taken from this, or that a person, if you take male or female slaves to the court outside the city gates and put to death, this is on and on. There is very little of it that is even vaguely close to the Torah law. There's a few of them that are quoted, and the question is, I invite yourself, go on to, there are quite a few sites that contain Wright's translation of it, and very, very little of it bears any type of, for instance, if a man is guilty of incest with his daughter, he shall be driven from the place. He's put to death by din, and so on. In reading through it, it's not that we have different halachas, it is completely different. Yes, there are two, three, or four that sound similar, but again, stealing an eved and paying for it and so on there might be one thing that happens to be the same, but I think an objective reading of it would not anywhere put it closer. That's one. Two, it's interesting, to say, well, it's a code of law. We have a chazal, we have many chazal that speaks about the door of Noach was mekabel on themselves arayas, to be go themselves in arayas. So we read it to say, what do you think? They had a Sanhedrin there and they got together and the rabbis made a kokore. But yes, they had codes of laws. This is the rising codes of laws. We read about stone and they had all sorts of laws and so on and so forth. So it's kind of stories. They did have codes of laws. Look at that. They have a whole bunch of them. And and it is interesting that Chazal do tell us that there were codes of laws, etc. And this is what they're like. There's also another element. We do know that Avraham Avinu. We have Chazal have a Mesoris of Avraham Avinu. By the way, if one deceives a barber and have him mark a slave not for sale with the sign of a slave, he shall be put to death and buried in his house. The barber shall swear, I did not mark him willingly, and shall be guiltless. I don't know, so I guess barbers here were kind of, it was a risky trade. But I encourage you to go through the 281 of them and find out how many might be similar. If you date Hammurabi's code to be basically the time of Avraham Avinu had a code of laws that was Torah. It didn't have a din of Torah and so on, but we know he was Mekayim Kol HaTorah Kulo, which means he was Mechavin to what the Torah wants, and things could have been borrowed from him. But I'm just saying, if you, an honest reading of it, so if the Torah is kind of a vague type of, vague set of ideas, so you say, okay, we've got some vague ideas here, vague ideas there, they borrow from each other. It's not like it at all. And the same thing is true if you read the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's so much a myth, and one or two or three things there sound somewhat familiar. To us, it wouldn't be surprising. For instance, the flood, the idea of a flood taking around the entire world is something which is almost universal narrative in different ways about a flood having overtaken the world. Now, so you can look at it in two ways. The scientists say, the secular people would say, listen, that is obviously a myth, and we'll talk a little bit about the scientific points of it. So take a look. Some great storyteller must have told the story of a flood, and that's why everybody picked it up. But we say it, we understand, it was a historical event. So everybody is conscious of the fact there was a flood. The story became distorted, the story became padded, the story became diluted in places. But the fact that there's a universal sense of a flood is supportive. It's something which kind of points out maybe that's the truth. So Al Kapanim, in all of these things, in these codes of laws, and also in the codes of laws and these epics of narrative creations, they're so, if you read it inside, people quote it offhand, but if you take the trouble to read them, you say to yourself, it's like so much chaff and one little piece of grain. There's no resemblance between the Gilgamesh epic and the Torah. Yes, there's a creation of light, but it's mixed in somewhere in the middle, and it's got very, very little closeness to the Torah. And to say that one came from the other is very difficult. So, by and large, as far as the type of the archaeology, the dating, and so on and so forth, I think we have a reasonable sense of two things. I think that's very important. One is the fact that the facts are not hard and fast. The further back you go in time, the harder it is that scientifically we establish anything. It disappears, and we find rocks. We do find rocks, but exactly what they were and how they were and so on, it keeps shifting because it's a puzzle with a lot of open pieces, and different people make different arrangements out of it. The early languages, being that they are pictograms of sort, are really, really, when it is translated in precise language, we lose out on it. We do very strongly believe that Klal Yisrael had the emes, and that started with Avraham Avinu, and those ideas diffused outwards to other umos. It's not particularly academic to say that. You always want to look at yourself as being influenced by other cultures, but we believe that to be emes, and there's absolutely no evidence to the contrary whatsoever. The one topic that's left over, there's also type of evidence of actions. Pinchas pointed out before, why don't we find descriptions of big nisim in other? Why don't we find any descriptions of big events? To which the answer is, there were no objective writers, and if the event was detrimental to any culture, or if the culture became impoverished, like Egypt or whatever, they would usually not write about it. They didn't have the time. They didn't care to write about it. I mean, all the writings that you have are not histories. They're monuments. These stelves, everything, these are all kind of monuments, proclamations, stuff like that. That's what they invested in. They did not invest in objective histories. You also find things like, we don't find a record of a large number of people having lived in the desert all those years, and in the desert wouldn't preserve, and so on and so forth. That's always a very, to start with, lo ra'ina in araya, we should have found evidence, is always not a great position. But what's amazing is, if, for instance, the evidence we should have found, all sorts of food leftovers like we find in sites and rubbish dumps and clothing and stuff like that. But the Torah says, and Chazal say, they ate man, and that did not leave over junk. We know that the clothing didn't rot and so on and so forth. So you can't tell me you don't believe the Torah because those are stories, and since we don't find any archaeological finds of the junk that they left behind and so on, that disproves the Torah. The Torah is very consistent. And if you go with the stories where they're told, one would not expect to find very many things. The only area that we do have left, there are two very important areas, and that is, so let's go so on. From Avraham Avinu onwards, by now, people agree, certainly from Klai Yisrael going to Eretz Yisrael, there's an agreement that the facts are as it says. They'll dispute the Nisim. From Avraham Avinu to Klai Yisrael going to Mitzrayim, they still are iffy about it, and they say there's a vague truth to it, and so on and so forth. That's the most current academic understanding. But from Avraham and beforehand is where there are arguments and so-called proofs against it. First of all, the flood, the Mabul should have left a mark. That's something that is not, you can't say Lorena and Araya. I mean, no, one would have found strata that have layers and layers of, a flood layer or something like that. That's one issue that we'll have to deal with. And the second issue is the evolution, not in the sense that we spoke about as life coming in on its own, but we find tons of materials that are obviously older than the Torah's dating. In other words, we'll find trees with many rings more than the date that we've worked out from the Torah is 5,700 years. We find the Earth's geological age is much older. We find bones and stuff buried that we can date with carbon dating and so on and so forth. Those are things that we need to deal with as well. So this is a second type. It's not evolution. You don't even have to come on to evolution, but hey, you're telling me that the world started 5,700 years ago. We find layers and layers of sediment. We can date the world geologically. We can date the world with various living artifacts, with carbon dating and other types of dating, and that seems to prove against it. Those are issues next time that we really have to confront. Any questions, Pinchas? Okay, good. So Emet Hashem next week we'll work with that, and I think that'll be kind of the end of the sort of background information, and then we'll start to work more on what the Torah wants, and et cetera, and things like that.